this talk, I want to discuss the other kinds of descent system, that is the uterine or matrilineal systems and the bilineal or non-unilineal systems, and also to look at inheritance. Uterine systems, that is inheritance through the female, constitute about 15% of all the unilineal systems. They are less common than patrilineal systems. And examples of them would be, for example, the Bemba, the Trobriand Islands, or the Crow Indians. In such systems, of course, descent is through the female, and also inheritance and rights in property tend to be through the female line. And yet, it's a mistake to think of them as societies where authority and power also lies in females. Sometimes there is a good deal of authority, but usually in such societies the dominant sex roles are those of the male, and they don't coincide with the descent and inheritance principles. The sex that counts in the reckoning of group membership is nevertheless the inferior one in most other situations. For example, men hold positions of authority in the domestic and political activities. And in such a situation, you therefore get what is known as the matrilineal puzzle. That is, the problem of combining these two different principles. Combining the principle that the women are the people through whom descent flows, and the men are the ones who need to run the system, and particularly the women's brothers. In these societies, a man's inheritance, instead of going to his son, passes to his sister's son. This is because in matrilineal societies, no less than patrilineal, authority and property holding are mainly the man's prerogative, even though it goes through a woman. Now, how does one deal with this problem? Because, of course, these are also societies where you have outmarriage, exogamy, and in such a situation, a man and his sister, who should be cooperating, are going to be split. The woman is going to move away, or the man is going to move away in marriage, and you have this tension between trying to keep them together and yet also trying to allow them to be apart. And there have been various solutions that human societies have evolved for dealing with the matrilineal puzzle. 4% of matrilineal societies do something which is very peculiar to us. They have what is known as duo-local residence, that is, two-fold residence. What that in effect means is that they resolve the problem by the brothers and sisters remaining together, as they did among the Nayars, for example, of South India. And this means, of course, if brothers and sisters remain together, the sacrifice is that husbands and wives cannot be together, because the brothers and sisters are there and the man doesn't move away, the woman doesn't move away. So what do you do with marriage? Well, you do what the 19th century islanders of the island of Tory Island off the west coast of Ireland did, which is that husbands and wives don't live together. You get sometimes night visiting, they'll visit each other at night, but they don't actually live together most of the time. And this duo-local residence system is one that is one solution, just living apart as husband and wife. A second solution is alternating marriage, which is a solution, for example, adopted by the Dobu Islands, studied by Rio Fortune. And in this, the husband and the wife alternate annually between his and her kinship group. One year they're in one group, another year they're in the other, so that you keep up your contacts with your brothers and sisters by this mechanism. Something similar to what we do at Christmas, those of us who are married and who have the problem of whether we shall spend Christmas with his relatives or her relatives, and we often adopt an alternating system. The third solution is virilocal marriage. Virilocal means at the husband's place. A woman joins the man, as with the Hopi Indians, and in such a situation, the male members of the dominant sex are living with affines. In other words, their sisters have gone away. So all the men are there, but they've lost their sisters, who are basically their integrating force. They're separated, in other words, from their matri clansfolk. And in such a situation, therefore, you've got the problem again. The other solution, of course, is uxorilocal marriage, which is at the wife's, the uxor's place. But in this situation, all the men have gone away to marry the women, the men are scattered, the women live together. And again, you get the same problems. So that the only solution, the only really logical solution to the matrilineal puzzle, in the end, is for marriage to collapse as an effective living together of a man and a woman. But this is a solution which is usually intolerable and not often adopted. Basically, as the American anthropologist Schneider points out, matrilineal systems must retain control over both the male and the female members. Whereas in a patrilineal system, where both the authority and the power and also the property and everything else is in the male line, they don't face this problem. And this, as we'll see later, may help to explain differential divorce rates in different kinds of society. Although the matrilineal system is the last of the unilineal systems I want to look at, I now want to look at what are known as non-unilineal. In other words, they're not just in one line. These systems, non-unilineal or bilineal systems, have been neglected by anthropologists until fairly recently. There are few of them in the traditional anthropological hunting grounds of Africa and Asia. They're mainly to be found in the Pacific, in Europe and North America, and Japan, and of course England and the rest of Western Europe. They haven't been studied because they're rather difficult to study. It's difficult to study one's own system. The exotic systems of other societies first attracted attention, and then coming back to understand our own took time. They're also difficult to study because whereas the unilineal systems form discrete blocks, matrilineages, this system is much more loose and a network of ties which doesn't have discrete groups, except in the exception I'll talk about. A better way of visualizing these systems is to think of things, such things as the hub of a wheel, an individual as the hub of a wheel with spokes going out from him, or a network, or dyadic, that is two ends, dyadic ties with people. And it's only with the development of ideas of strands and networks that it's been possible to understand such non-unilineal systems. Also, they're not comparatively very important. They're the minority of societies, only 40% of human societies have such systems, where we happen to be in Western Europe, one of them. Though, of course, they do include such societies as North America and Western Europe. What are the major features of these non-unilineal systems? As Radcliffe Brown describes it, you have a system where a stock, that is a group of people who think of themselves as related to each other, includes all the descendants of a man and his wife, counting descent through both females and males. In the Sib system, that's as it was often known, based on the Anglo-Saxon system, a man belongs to each of the eight stocks of his eight pairs of great-grandparents, and all descendants of these ancestors are his kin. Thus, you are related to hundreds, if not thousands, of people because you're tracing descent through both males and females, and you don't have a bounded set of relatives. Now, there are two major forms of such descent systems. Unfortunately, both are represented on the British mainland by the two contrasting systems of the English and the Scots. We can distinguish the two major forms by the way in which they think of themselves as focusing and being related to each other. That is their focus. In normal English kinship, the focus of the system, and the one which is common in France or North America, is the ego, that is I. The system is based upon the network of ties that radiate out, that's why one has an image of a wheel with a hub, that radiate out from any individual through kin of both sexes, and then descend from these ascendants to your kin on either side. As a result, your kin are private to you. The only people who have the same set of kin are brothers and sisters. Your cousins will have a different set, and so on. Whereas in a unilineal system, the lineage, everyone has the same set, they're in a bounded group. So you have a personal kindred who are your relatives, your first cousins, your second cousins, and you carry them round like hubs on a wheel with you, and the next, your children have a different set from you because they are related through their mother and their father. This system can't give rise to permanent groups. No two people's kindred are the same, and there are no descent groups, lineages, and so on. This is why we find descent systems which do have groups so strange. Examples of this system, as well as the English, are those among some groups of Eskimos, and they have rather similar kinship terminologies to the English one, and that is why, in fact, our kinship terminology, which is rather like the hub of a wheel, at the center is us, mother, father, son, daughter, and then a wider group of cousins, nephews, nieces, and then wider and wider and wider. Some Eskimos have a similar kinship terminology, and indeed our kinship terminology is known as an Eskimo kinship terminology because it is very similar to that. Other groups which have such an ego-focused, non-unilineal descent system are the Kalingas, some Tibetans, some Laps. It seems to be particularly people who live in the Antarctic and Arctic regions who have such systems. The other type of non-unilineal descent system is the one where the focus is not on the individual when you're reckoning your kin links, but on your common ancestor. An example of this is the early Scottish sept, which is a form of clan, in which links were traced through both sexes, but from a common ancestor. I was told by my father that I was related closely and intimately with Rob Roy MacGregor. I don't quite know how it worked, but apparently all members of my clan were descended from either Rob Roy or some other ancestor. In this system, you can actually get a group of people on the ground who are related either through males or females back to a particular ancestor. So you have an ancestor-focused system. And what you do in practice, as anthropologists have discovered, is that you, when you're thinking about who you're related, you don't work outward from yourself. But in Irish kinship studies, it's been shown that you go back to 4 or 5 generations. You think of, well, that was my ancestor. Now, he had 4 sons, and each of those sons had the following children, and then they had the following children. And then, when you want to know how you are related to someone down the road, you know that you go back and trace down the descent like that. Now, holding it in the mind like that means that you can hold hundreds of relatives in your mind as being related, and you know the precise genealogical links. Our system is very good as a loose system, but it'll only hold a few people in your mind, and you probably won't know how your second, third, fourth cousins are related to you. So in the ancestor-focused system, you have a clan structures, and such systems have been discovered not only in Scotland, but also, for example, in the famous island study, the Tikapia, studied by Raymond Firth in the Pacific, or the Iban of Borneo, studied by Freeman and others. You find ancestor-focused, non-unilineal descent systems. I'd now finally like to turn to inheritance, because this is a subject which is often neglected. What is inheritance? Well, inheritance is the transmission of rights in property. And of course, we all think we know what property is. We all tend to think in our own way about property being an object, this watch, for example, or this Naga figure here being property. In fact, anthropologists and economists and others regard property not as the object, but the relationship you have with an object. It is not this Naga figure that is my property. My property is a right I have to destroy, give away, sell, or otherwise this Naga figure. And therefore, you can have property in all sorts of things, what lawyers often call incorporeal property, that is, rights in things which don't have any actual body, a right in the presentation to a living, as a Cambridge College might have, or rights in some societies to songs, to dreams, to secret spells, to all sorts of things. Now, these rights in property are transmitted in various ways and at various times. Usually they occur at particular times. They occur in certain phases of the life cycle. In most societies, property is transmitted late on. Often it's transmitted actually at death or at marriage. And therefore, in peasant societies, for instance, often parents retain great control over property and only transmit it at the last minute to their children, and this keeps their children in check. Sometimes it's tied to marriage, and therefore marriages cannot occur without the transmission of property to children through dowry and other mechanisms which I'll describe. One of the characteristic features of the transformation of societies from basically landed agricultural societies to industrial ones is that property now is much more diffused, and the transmission, since most property now doesn't actually flow through individual families, much of it flows through the state. Children are much less dependent than they were, except in possibly the top 0.5% of society, much less dependent on their parents' own transmission of property. We receive all the important things, or many of the important things, like health care, policing, education, and even housing and access to jobs, not through our parents' efforts and what is transmitted to us at death by our parents, but earlier on in our lives through the welfare state and other institutions like that. So it doesn't really matter so much, but in most societies, the actual point at which property is transmitted has been very important. It occurs through these various channels I've mentioned, through education, through dowry, and through inheritance in the technical sense of someone actually giving you money or stock. To whom does it go? Well, the major distinction anthropologists make is between property which goes downwards. In our society, we have for many centuries had the idea that property flows down. It must flow down from parents to children and to grandchildren. It cannot ascend, and it tends to go down from generation to generation. Jack Goody and others have pointed out that in Africa, the main flow of property goes sideways, what you call lateral inheritance rather than vertical inheritance. If you die, it'll go to your brother and to all the other siblings until that generation is exhausted, and then it'll go to the next generation. Finally, there is the particular way in which property is divided, whether it's held to be a right of all the children or whether it's just to one or two of them. And our own system again has been peculiar in having a very strong emphasis on impartible inheritance. That's to say, it's not divided, and it tended to go to the eldest male son, primogeniture. Most societies conceive of property being that property of the family as a whole, and therefore all the sons equally, and probably all the daughters have an equal share. You cannot be disinherited from your property, since at birth you are born into it, whereas in our system you can be disinherited. And therefore we tended to have an impartible and disinheritable system, whereas other societies have divisibility and an automatic right.